All right, folks, we're going to mix up the order just a little bit to make some audiovisual accommodations here. We're going to start the panel first, and I'd like to thank our sponsors, Colorado O-Edit, where we'll hear from them after the panel discussion. And right now I'd like to introduce Dr. Robert Pollock. He has worked at senior levels in government and consultancy in relation to regional and territorial development for almost 30 years, and it has advised the EC, OECD, UN agencies, and the World Bank on issues such as energy transition and industrial development. He is currently a senior advisor to the European Union's Coal Regions in Transition Initiative and leads delivery of its technical assistance program to support a just transition in affected regions. He has a PhD related to energy transition, multi-level governance, and industrial development. He is currently a visiting scholar at the College of Europe, researching the internationalization of the EU's just transition agenda. Between 2015 and 2020, he was a chair of the Economic Development Association of Scotland. Please welcome Dr. Robert Pollock. And now at this time, can we go ahead and have the other panelists join Dr. Robert Pollock up here on the stage?
I thought it was going to be very lonely. Quite a relief I've got other panelists, and what fine panelists they are. So, yeah. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Well, I'm delighted to be here today. I must say it's lovely being in a room with people. It is just a very special moment. And this is the first time I've actually moderated live for, must be nearly 2 years. So it's a lovely feeling. And I think this is the third time this year I've worn a suit. So it's quite a memorable day on many levels. So I'm really delighted to be moderating this session today. And as we know, this is the second session entitled A Just Transition, Net Zero, Renewables, Clean Tech, and Energy Transition. And interestingly, the question posed in your program is, are these merely industry buzzwords or real drivers of corporate growth and sustainable development? Well, I'm sorry to give you a plot spoiler right at the outset, but yes, they are not buzzwords. They are fundamentally important for corporate growth, economic development, and the future of foreign direct investment globally. Since the Paris summit of 2015, the COP agreement that countries would strive to keep temperature rise to no more than 1.5 degrees, there has been an acceleration in the drive to net zero. And I think it's fair to say this has been a paradigm shift for the economies of the world, and it will only become more evident what a paradigm shift it is in the coming years. And this is a process of disruptive transition that comes with its own set of concepts: decarbonization, circular economy, sustainability, and just transition. And these are issues and concepts that we'll be exploring today through the panel discussion. As you heard from Charles, I'm an advisor to the European Commission, assisting regions that are undergoing transition from coal and carbon-intensive industries. So I've seen firsthand over the last 3 or 4 years how net zero is fundamentally restructuring regional and local economies in terms of their economic structure, their supply chains, their business models, and also challenging vested interests within these economies. It really is a step change in the way we need to undertake economic development. When I was speaking with Martin last night on the phone, he says, this is an incredibly complex issue. You know, and he's right, it is an incredibly complex issue. And it's a set of challenges that we have to deal with as investors and as foreign direct investment support agencies. But there are great opportunities. So, for example, I've been working in Silesia in southern Poland, which is 80,000 miners. They're beginning to phase out many of the mines, but there has actually been the development of a cluster nobody expected around e-buses, e-mobility, and electric buses. Again, I've worked in northern Spain, in Asturias, a region of Europe with a long tradition of coal and steel, and they are now working towards green steel, producing green steel through the use of hydrogen. So it's a very complex issue. There's many challenges for local and regional economies and national economies ahead, but there are opportunities, and there are opportunities for inward investment. I just want to say a few words about the European Union level. Obviously, the European Union is one of the three big global economies. There's the USA, there's China, and there's obviously the European Union. And the European Union has effectively bet the house on net zero and has established the European Green Deal 2 years ago. A new strategy was introduced that is fundamentally reframing industrial policy and economic policy in the European Union, the European Green Deal. Three aspects: net zero by 2050, decoupling economic growth from resources, and fundamentally no persons left behind. And that's about just transition, the very start of the title of today's session, just transition. And what is just transition? It means economic justice for those affected by decarbonisation and net zero, and the communities affected. And again, that notion of just transition was further enshrined at COP26 in Glasgow in November of last year, Glasgow being only 40 miles away. And it's about avoiding the winners and losers of transition. We've all seen how industrial transitions of the past have created winners and losers. I'm from the west of Scotland. The transition out of shipbuilding, steel, coal left communities blighted. The European Union is committed to ensuring that doesn't happen. It needs to be a planned transition to net zero. And I'm sure we'll be discussing that today. How do we plan a transition to net zero that is just? And what is the role of foreign direct investment in that process? So the aims of the session today are relatively straightforward. Firstly, consider the drive to net zero and how that is shaping corporate priorities, but also government priorities. And in turn, what are the opportunities for sustainable development and investment? A second aim, which we would like to understand, is how can the opportunities be optimized? And how can these opportunities be optimized quickly? And I think that's one of the big challenges, is we're having to move fast in regard to the move to net zero. So how do we optimize these opportunities for the benefit of our communities, our local, regional, and national economies, and do it in an efficient and effective and expedient manner? So we're not going to be overly rigid in our discussion today. It's quite a large area. But I'm delighted that we have three fantastic panelists who are going to share their professional perspectives and their insights from their relative positions. And I'm hoping we will have a discussion probably for about 30, 40 minutes. And then, as Charles said, we'll be hearing from Colorado about their proposition and the opportunity which they can offer global investors. But I do want to make some time for Q&A, because I do think this is a fundamental topic that merits a discussion from the floor. So I'd like to spend maybe 15, 20 minutes on Q&A. But anyway, I'd like to introduce the panel now. And the first panelist I'd like to introduce is in the middle, and this is Helen Barrow. Helen is the UK and Ireland Power Generation and Infrastructure Managing Director for Accenture. I'm sure many of you know Accenture. It's a global professional services company with specialized skills across 40 industries with clients in over 120 countries. Helen's role includes delivering projects for clients across the low-carbon generation lifecycle, from capital program delivery to operational optimization, the whole spectrum. She also leads Accenture's net zero team, where she works to develop decarbonization strategies, particularly focusing on how data, digital, and collaboration can accelerate results. A very interesting fusion between net zero and digital transitions. There's many transitions going on globally, not just net zero. Helen's worked in low carbon and infrastructure for 20 years, both in industry and consulting, and is passionate about sustainability and the power of change to enable us to meet net zero goals. So welcome to the panel, Helen. To my immediate right is Greg Cool, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Michelin Scotland's Innovation Park in Dundee. Prior to this, Greg spent 35 years in a range of diverse roles at Michelin, initially spending 18 years in a manufacturing environment. Greg then took up the position as Business and Marketing Director for Michelin Lifestyle Limited UK. In 2011, Greg moved to France to become European Marketing Director, and laterally for the past 4 years as Customer Racing Director for Michelin's Motorsport, which just sounds like a dream job, I have to say. In 2020, Greg returned to his roots in Dundee and to the position of Chief Executive Officer at Michelin Scotland Innovation Park. So welcome, Greg. And finally, by deduction, the gentleman at the end is Professor Martin Tagney. And Martin is an international figure in the low-carbon sector, informing the policy debate around the world. An international award-winning innovator, he has established the first biofuel centre in the UK and made global headlines for his patented processes for producing biobutanol, a sustainable, advanced biofuel and renewable chemical. From the byproducts of the whisky industry, he's making these products from the byproducts of the whisky industry, so a commendable effort helping the Scottish economy on many levels. And he has commercialized this process through the establishment of his firm, Celtic Renewables. As a recognized thought leader, Martin has featured in a range of media around the world and publications from the National Geographic to Time magazine. His innovation has been equally applauded by NGOs, industry leaders, and government. In recognition of his achievements, he was awarded an OBE in 2018. So this is the panel we have assembled today for you to discuss the question of just transition and the move to net zero. So let's just open this up into a conversation on these topics. And Helen, one of the things I'd like to ask you is you've been involved in decarbonisation, the low-carbon economy for 20 years, and obviously over that time you've seen it moving from something that was often considered quite peripheral to the corporate development process, the economic development process, foreign direct investment, to something that's now centre stage. So can you give the audience just some thoughts, give an overview of the main levers that will get us to net zero in the coming years and within quite a tight time frame? So over to you, Helen.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. So within Accenture, we've come up with a framework of five levers that we feel tackles this very broad subject, because quite often in decarbonisation, we can just focus on the power generation or just the transport. So we've tried to bring a holistic view. So I'll just quickly describe those five things. So the first is about reinventing demand and behaviour. And this is about how organisations adapt or introduce their products to be more sustainable. It's about how we as individuals change our behavior, change our habits, and adopt new low carbon technologies. And it's also about how governments create the incentives, policy, or frameworks to enable that change. So it's kind of the all of us and the role that we all play collectively. Next is decarbonizing industry. And really this is about, you know, entire supply chains and entire industries. So from the manufacturing and production of products to the transport of products to getting them to consumers. And the focus really on decarbonized industry is around buildings and the really hard to abate industries. We mentioned steel earlier, kind of steel, concrete, these very asset intensive industrial processes that we need to decarbonize to make the change. The third area is transport. And again, you know, even just electric vehicles, we could probably have a whole panel on the opportunity there, but this is beyond just, you know, consumer EVs. It's about mass transport, sustainable aviation, maritime, and all the infrastructure that you need to enable that. The next one, which is closest to my experience, is around decarbonizing the energy system. So this really is about the moving to low carbon power generation through nuclear and renewable sources, but also adapting our transmission and distribution to cope with that, you know, lots of smaller assets on the grid rather than single bigger assets that we see as we move to renewables. And then the final part is really the net of net zero, so recovery and removals, which is about the capturing of carbon or the biodiversity and kind of offsetting aspects. So it's a huge topic, and you know, we've tried to have that holistic view because we recognise that our clients may operate across all aspects of that wheel, you know, those five things. And so you need to have that integrated conversation, although, you know, a lot of the time the first place people go to for decarbonisation is around the power generation and how do you move to more sustainable power.
Thank you, Helen. Just moving on to you, Greg, you know, I just like your thoughts. You know, you've obviously been in the related to the automotive industry for many years. The automotive industry has been a huge driver of foreign direct investment across the world. You know, and if you look at the European economy, so much of the European economy's manufacturing bases are built around the automotive industry. So I was wondering whether you've got any insights for the audience on what are the corporate drivers that are leading to net zero. You know, some broad perspectives, and then perhaps focusing in your business area around sustainable mobility and decarbonisation.
Yeah, thank you. So, absolutely, one of the key movers in all of everything that's happening at the moment is legislation and the commitments that all the governments have taken individually and collectively. Not least of which is Scotland. So by 2045, we want to be net zero compared with 1990, but 75% down by 2030, which is just round the corner. And actually, every single business and every single organisation, large or small, is going to have to adapt to that and subscribe to these goals, which are themselves inscribed in legislation. Secondly, the previous panel talked a lot about ESG credentials, and investors as well as consumers are now actively looking for those aspects of a business's organisation. And indeed, in all the databases that we hold at MSIP of fund holders and investors, and at whatever stage they might be in the overall journey, all of them express an interest in ESG. But thirdly, there are a lot of opportunities out there now, and there are particular opportunities for those who can move quickly and essentially grab part of the market share and the market that is growing. At MSIP, our activity, I would say, is mainly focused on mitigation rather than adaptation. There's a lot of work going on to accept and adapt to what's happening today. Ours is all about mitigation, finding the solutions to decarbonize and to have sustainable mobility. In order to do that, we've put together an organization which rose out of a fairly almost catastrophic set of circumstances in Dundee, where the biggest employer of Dundee, which was Michelin at the time, concluded after 50 years of activity, that they were going to have to close the plant for sound economic reasons, but a very difficult set of circumstances. Michelin have always been a very ethical company. They were one of the first to subscribe to corporate social responsibility activities, subconsciously, because that's just the way they worked. And in previous times, whenever a factory has closed, whenever an activity has come to its natural end, there was always a bit of investment and help for local businesses to try and grow and adapt to the kind of shock wave that went through the community. In this instance, however, Team Scotland, in the guise of Scottish Enterprise and Dundee City Council, and Michelin got together and said, perhaps there's something different that we can do with the 32 hectares and 750,000 square feet of infrastructure that we've got here, rather than flattening it and building, you know, houses or another commercial retail park. So each of those groups put £30 million on the table and created MSIP. And our aim really is to help all these companies who are transitioning, who are going through all of these steps to become net zero, to grow and thrive.
Thanks, Greg. I'd actually quite like to come back to that model in a moment to discuss how it could be used as a model for attracting inward investment. So we'll return to that.
Okay.
But Martin, obviously, you know, you have got a significant scientific interest in the whole move to net zero. Your company is very much built around the bioeconomy, et cetera. I was wondering, what are your thoughts in terms of the challenges of moving to net zero? And but also the opportunities, potentially from the inward investment perspective?
That's a little question.
It's a little question, actually. It's a compound question, apologies.
Huge for both of those. I think the challenges are that there seems, in my view, a lack of concept of what total net zero really means and where you're talking about. Is it global net zero? Is it just here? You know, you set a target. I mean, 2050 is a figure you can throw out there a long way down the road. There are a lot of people in the world. 2050 means 10 to 9 tonight. Is my world a better place than 10 to 9 tonight? That's all that matters. So I don't know how you get that global concept of net zero. And as you said a while ago, everything needs to be focused on energy, and carbon goes everywhere. We made history for mad Irishmen takes whiskey and sticks it into a car. That's not quite true. We take the residues from the whiskey industry. I use whiskey because it's the biggest source of abundant residual biological material here in this country. If I was somewhere else, I'd probably have invented it using something else. And we simply squeeze value out of that and make high-value carbon chemicals out of those residues. One of them is butanol, which you can put into a car and drive off, which we've done, and it's perfectly sound, and that is a way forward for transitioning in the fuel sector if you want to do that. But we use that every single day of the week in our lives. You just don't see it. Chemicals are used everywhere all the time. Your glasses were made with chemicals, your pen, the ink in there, your makeup, there's sanitary products, pharmaceutical products, and we need all these. You know, there's a lot of for me, in the net zero thing, is about telling everybody all the things you can't do. We've got to stop doing this, don't use this. There's loads of stuff that we either can't do without, or we've just become so accustomed to it that we won't do without it. And these are all made from, oil is more than fuel. Oil is more than just generating electricity. You know, there's more to life than energy. Chemicals, we use them all the time. And oil is actually a very precious resource that we need to manage rather than demonize. And for me, it's about changing our dependence on oil, which really, I've got my high horse here now, it's really only been 100 years that we've become dependent on oil. We survived particularly well without it for long periods by innovating. We still had industrial revolutions and everything. Arguably, we shouldn't have had it, but we did. You know, when we've managed to innovate our way out of all sorts of spheres in life. And I think this total dependence since after the Second World War, when the Saudi Arabian fields were commercialized, that dependence on oil was very, very quick and very, very sharp. And we just need to replace it in its entirety. And there's no magic bullet here. We're not going to find a single, unless aliens land and give us some new form of power, we're not going to replace oil with a like-for-like substitution. And this has to be a carefully integrated energy, chemicals, and sustainability mix. We need to grow a new style of economy. And for me, it's a bioeconomy. That oil is just more long dead, you know? It's long dead biological material, but it's still fundamentally biological material.
Thank you, Martin. I think what you have brought forward, but all the panelists have, you know, clearly noted this, is we're not talking about industrial change, we're talking about systems change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that is so fundamental, especially for government. You know, in the past, foreign direct investment has often been about targeting certain industries, whereas the opportunity is perhaps to stand back and say, how is the actual economic system changing? You know, whether it's through biofuels, the move from fossil fuels to biofuels, whether it's e-mobility or new forms of mobility.
And there's the flip side to your question. Where's the opportunity? Imagine replacing oil with something else.
Yeah.
How big an opportunity is that? And it's not but one thing. It'll be wind, it'll be wave, it'll be chemicals, bioeconomy,
exactly.
Biotechnology.
It is about understanding the opportunity. And I know, Helen, you've been doing quite a lot of work in terms of energy and offshore wind, and that's been a huge driver for the UK economy in terms of foreign direct investment. We've seen some very significant investments by big global players like Siemens setting up manufacturing facilities in Humberside. We're now beginning to see that happen in Scotland with the ScotWind leasing round. So we're beginning to see, you know, green energy really becoming a bit of a player in terms of FDI. Any thoughts in terms of, you know, how you seize those opportunities for regional economies or local economies?
For me? Yeah.
Yeah, please help.
So I think UK offshore wind is a really interesting story, and it's worth kind of going back and looking at the last 20 years and where we've come from as an example of a net zero technology, and how you need to create, you know, a whole new industry, new supply chain, or repurpose, you know, skills and resources that are already available. So 20 years ago, we had, you know, a couple of demonstrator turbines offshore, and today we've got 10 gigawatts on the grid. We've got plans to get to 40, so four times by 2030. So, you know, not long for that. In terms of the progression that we've seen, even in the last 10 years, if you look at the levelized cost of that electricity, it's reduced from £155 a megawatt hour down to prices of as low as 40. And the technology has matured and innovated such that the original turbines were around 90 metres, so Statue of Liberty size. Now they're 300 metres, which is like the Shard in London. So that journey of progression, and, you know, arguably that innovation still happening, and they may improve further. But so we've got three times the size, five times the power at a quarter of the cost in a short time. And, you know, that was really enabled by everyone getting together to say we have to make this industry work. And in 2011, kind of government policy around the EMR. And there were three things that I thought were interesting that happened that can think about how do you create this environment to build a whole industry. The first was the need for demand. So the ROCs, the renewable obligation certificates, that was people had to sell a certain proportion of electricity that was renewable. So I've got a market straight away. So if I'm going to invest, I know I've got a customer for my product. The second was around kind of financial frameworks to again, make sure that there was certainty in the investment around the auctions and contracts for difference. So that if I'm investing in something that does take a while to come to market, I do know that there's some you know, certainty around that investment later on. And the last one was around, you know, the skills and supply chain, and, you know, similarly to what we've heard in the example for Dundee of, you know, putting money in to create those new skills. We're talking port infrastructure, you know, manufacturing facilities, innovation and research, R&D. And I think, you know, whilst there are still challenges to meet this huge scaling, if you think actually 20 years ago to today, then that's something new that we've created to support this net zero transition. And, you know, I'm sure there's bumps on the road to that, but at a kind of macro level, that's the journey we've been on. You know, the ScotWind auctions recently, a large proportion of that was for floating offshore. That's a whole nother set of innovation that's coming. So that's one example. You know, there are other low net zero technologies, low carbon technologies that are at much earlier in the maturity, some that are more established. And I mean, it's just a whole world of opportunity, as you say, to create lots of different sources as we manage the energy transition.
Yeah. I think what really strikes me from what you've been saying, Helen, is the importance of a stable regulatory framework. You know, this is not, you can attract FDI in terms of net zero, but a lot of it is not just based on traditional incentives, such as, you know, grants, training, etc. It's about ensuring a long-term regulatory stable environment, given the, you know, the investment cycles of these industries are so long-term. I was just wondering, Martin, from your view on the transition of the chemical industry, what's your thoughts on how inward investment can be attracted? Is it going to be around stable regulatory environments? What will you know, the biochemicals inward investment proposition look like?
Yeah, I would say you can't underestimate the role of subsidies in that development of the wind industry either. You know, without that, would we be here today? You know, so I think that needs to be looked at. How you do it in the chemical sector is more difficult because you have to measure it against, is it green? And there's an all-merciful amount of greenwashing going on out there at the moment. And it's difficult. How do you measure what something really genuine is in green? And that's where the foreign direct investment will have an issue as well, is who determines whether something is green technology or not a green technology. And I think that's something that governments and policymakers really need to have a good look at, because by definition, if it's innovative, it's not been done before. And you're comparing it with something that has been done before and using that as your counterfactual, and that's not a great idea. You know, you have to take that leap of faith. You know, Henry Ford said, if I'd asked the general public what they wanted, they'd have asked for a faster horse, right? So we'd never have seen the car. Maybe that's not a bad thing either, but that, and the wind was disruptive. You know, it was a disruptive intervention. I think we need a little bit of bravery and a bit of less risk-averse capital going in, because biotech industries are capital intensive. We heard it this morning in the first panel. Capital intensive, not huge employers, but the knock-on effect in communities is huge. It's usually high-skilled labor. Like, there's an island that people may not have heard of called Islay off the coast. The Scots will know what it is, but you will have heard of the whiskey that's under, Laphroaig, Lagavulin, very famous whiskey brands. 8 distilleries on the island. The residues from there are allowed by law to be put into the sea. We could disrupt that by using the same transport network and build a factory in the middle of the island, use exactly the same residues and do something with it, creating employment, using a brand new technology that's not been there before, that impacts on schools and shops and decarbonizes the island, does all that kind of thing. Would we go there on our own first? No. There are very good reasons why it's a remote island and it's difficult to get things off and on. And this is where the risk factor comes in. We have a running joke in the company. It's taken us 10 years and over £40 million to get to where we are, where we have the first biorefinery in the country, just been built at Grangemouth. We're in the process of commissioning it at the moment, and that's the first one. And it's really difficult to fund the first ones. And that's where I think the funding gap lies here, is everybody wants to be first to be second. Give me a McDonald's and I'll build one for you, no problem at all. But invent the burger, that's a slightly different question, you know? And I think that's where the risk lies with foreign investment coming in, is that the appetite for risk. And then that goes back to what the first panel discussed in quite a lot of detail, about how do you incentivize that money to come in? Where's the safe landing pad for that to come in? And that's the responsibility of the local governments. They have to incentivize that. They have to provide the wind subsidies, and they have to provide stable rocks and go, your money is safe in this country. You know, and Apple was used. I'm from Cork, and Apple, we grew up with Apple in Cork. Everybody knew about them. And the Irish government defended them to the hilt, and European government trying to get them to spend taxes. And they'd look at the knock-on effect in the economy, you know. And I think there's sort of bravery pills need to be taken on this transition to net zero. But it will be by innovation. And innovation has to be backed, and it has to be fully supported.
Yeah. We'll come on to the role of innovation in a moment in your industry. I'd like to pick up on that, but I'd quite like to ask Greg just about the Michelin Scotland Innovation Park, you know, as a model for attracting inward investment. So, for example, with offshore renewables, it has been very much about bringing the technology into the UK, attracting Siemens, attracting Vestas. But actually, the Innovation Park, which you've established in Dundee to support e-mobility, is actually about creating the technology in Dundee, then bringing the investor in, linking it to the technology. So it's quite an interesting model. Could you say a few more?
That's absolutely right.
Words on that.
First of all, we've had the incredible support of our three shareholders, as I said, Dundee City Council, Michelin, and the Scottish Government through Scottish Enterprise. And the idea was to create an ecosystem where companies could grow, develop, scale, and then attract inward investment as well. We've got an excellent example at the moment on the park. We now have Ballard Motive Solutions, but prior to Ballard Motive Solutions joining us, we had Arcola, a more modest-sized company, but very cutting-edge technology. We're looking at transforming old diesel power refuse collection vehicles and trains to hydrogen fuel cell. They did that successfully, but Ballard looked at that and said, well, here's an excellent opportunity for us to come in, invest with that, in that company, and grow our presence in Scotland. In fact, they actually bought over the company, which has allowed them to scale quickly. But what we're trying to do is create a melting pot where all of that can happen. So we have, yes, infrastructure, yes, space, where companies can come in. We're a kind of a landlord in one sense, in that we rent out space with heating and lighting and security and all the things you could imagine of a good landlord. But we want to layer on top of that three things, really. The first is to help companies have a lower total cost of operation. Dundee has a very equitable wage structure, but it's low compared with elsewhere. So there is interest in coming into the community. Secondly, we've got all the facilities now to help companies scale quickly. So we're going to have test and certification facilities. We've got a very close working relationship with the National Manufacturing Institute of Scotland. We have partnerships with the three local universities. So Dundee University, which I think is number one in Scotland for the net value of spin-offs and engineering expertise. Abertay, who look after cybersecurity, for example, which is going to be a big thing when we talk about last mile delivery and autonomous driving. And of course, St. Andrews, who are now, according to the Times Education Supplement, the number one university in the UK, with a lot of expertise in hydrogen and battery technology. So we're putting all of that together in the melting pot with, crucially, and a little hark back to the earlier panel, with a skills academy where we're going to try and deliver the skills that are going to be needed for the new technologies, things like working at height for servicing wind turbines or putting together a battery for an electric vehicle or installing ground source or air sourced heat pumps. All of these things such that companies get a one-stop shop, as it were, where we are, with also a third aspect, which is ESG, as we talked about this morning. So we've got very close working relationships with local third sector organisations, including one community trust who are based with us. So trying to put all three of these things together in this melting pot, which we sometimes refer to as the biggest coffee machine in Dundee, because everybody can meet there, ideate, swap ideas, and hopefully generate new ones. And we often talk about Dundee as a kind of a microcosm of Scotland, in that we refer to it as the Goldilocks city. It's not too big, and it's not too small. So everybody knows what the targets are, knows what the objectives are, and can collectively work together to that end.
Thanks, Greg. That was a great discussion about the role of collaboration and networking. And I was wondering, Helen, you know, I know you've done work on in terms of clusters and net zero clusters. And I'm wondering if you've got any views on how you develop collaborative models to develop a net zero economy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we believe digital and data are going to be key drivers to accelerate net zero, but the other one is all about collaboration. And it does feel, you know, you can have national policy, regional, local, but actually a lot of these changes can happen locally. And I think the clusters is a great example of, you know, geographic, industrial working together, and also net zero cities. So, you know, lots of people have come out to declare that there will be a net zero city. I think Edinburgh are one of the most ambitious, and I hope I get it right, it's 2030. So, you know, that's going to take local organisations, it's going to take the citizens, and it's going to take the local and regional governments as well. And I think it's the opportunity for people to come together around something that, you know, most people believe in. So it's not a hard thing to get people excited about solving the problem. And, you know, that's going to be what leads to the innovation. So definitely collaboration is needed to accelerate forward, because we can't all be working on our own solutions and, you know, have that time that's going to take.
And actually, that's a really important point, because for me, there's been too much of green technologies competing against each other,
right,
rather than collaboratively saying, how do we displace oil? You know, they're competing for the 10% of the market rather than the 90 bit that the oil still retains. And it's much more of this integration. And I think there's a huge For me, I see a company like nature doesn't do waste, right? You have a biological thing out there, you leave your stuff out the fridge too long, it'll decay, it'll go into something else. Nature doesn't do waste. It converts everything down to the last degree until there's nothing left and the gas has gone away again. So from my point of view, what we do is I see Celtic Renewables very much as a secondary business. Here, we're sort of tying ourselves to the primary industry of the whiskey industry, who takes biological resources and they convert some of that into whiskey and the rest that's left behind. We go, right, we're the secondary industry, we'll do nature on it for you, and we will convert that into the highest value product we possibly can out of it. And then other companies can say, well, we might be able to squeeze a little bit more value out of something before you get a hold of it. And that's true for the food industry, the agricultural industry, other drinks industries, anything that's a biological derived industry. The primary industry is put the food on your table, the bread and the croissants and everything you had outside. There's residues from every single thing you had out there, the jam that was on the croissants. That fruit was pulped and there's a residue left behind. And what I see us doing and other companies like Celtic Renewables, the biotech sector, is to go in and squeeze more carbon out of it and turn that into something valuable. And it may be, our view looking ahead, is that it wouldn't just be a Celtic Renewables technology. You'd have a primary industry bolted on two or three different technologies that are capable of doing different things with the residues and integrating them all together, whether it's generating the power for it and putting gas or electricity back in to become a self-sustaining unit. And that philosophy of integration of technologies, I think, is going to be critical in going forward.
How do Martin, government actors who are interested in attracting inward investment, identify the next big thing? You're obviously into biochemicals. We've talked about offshore wind, etc. But what would you say? You know, we're seeing new technologies rapidly emerging. You know, as we said, it's about systems change, new technologies within those systems. How can government identify where the opportunities lie for attracting inward investment?
Yeah, I mean, it's a stage-old question, isn't it? It's difficult because governments are on a shorter cycle than the planet has left here, right? So, you know, 2050, how many governments will we have seen between now and 2050? You know, so their mentality has to be, by definition, election cycle based on where it's going. And as they said in the panel this morning, you're looking at 25, 30 year stability for the investment coming in. And that's where I think that the issue will lie with just a government on its own. But if everybody's serious about it, in COP26, everybody said how serious they were, all the money was going to be set aside, we are going to achieve this, it's going to happen, then if you are going to do it, it has to be done like today. People have to say, we're not going to sit back and reevaluate something and analyze, is this a good opportunity, is that a bad opportunity? Analyze it to the nth degree, because all you're doing then is maintaining status quo. People have to take a little bit more risk. Some of the technologies won't work, but you have to bet them. If 2 out of 10 are mega ones that are going to save you, you don't focus on the 8 that failed. Focus on the 2 that did the job. You know, that's what we need to do, is take a little bit more risk on what's going to happen here. And some of these technologies will work quite well. We just need to back them a little bit more. For every one of us, there's 100 that never made it this far.
Yeah,
it's that old dilemma of picking winners or let 1,000 flowers bloom, which is often a difficult one for government actors to call.
Well, the reality is, that I said earlier on, that what we're doing, people go on about carbon capture and storage. Oil is nature's greatest carbon capture and storage process ever. And what we do is we dig it up, and that's where the carbon's coming from. We're digging it up and burning it and then trying to figure out how to put it back down again. What we should be focusing on now is, what are the ways that we can implement not digging it up? And that doesn't mean offsetting and planting trees. You've all sat in a taxi, probably, unless you sat in the bus yesterday, which was a little musical tour around Edinburgh. That was slightly different. And on taxis, they'll say, this taxi is 100% carbon neutral. No, it's not. The company has a net zero over its platform that makes their company net zero. The physical taxi is burning fuel, stuff went in to make it. Even if it's electricity, there's a battery in there, something went in to make it. The physical taxi is not carbon neutral. You've offset it by planting trees. Planting trees won't make your cleaning products and your physical entities, like pharmaceutical products. It won't do it for you. And we have to develop technologies that will replace oil in a real and meaningful way, rather than some computational sheet that says overall you're net zero. We genuinely have to replace the products. I'm all for recycling and reusing things and making sure that we squeeze the maximum value out of things. And a lot of that happened, I think, during COVID. People just realized, well, I don't need to change suits every second day. And probably, you know, I wore rugby shirts in the summer and I wore ski tops in the winter. And that was kind of it. The suit didn't come out of the wardrobe. It was strange to find them again and find it to probably fit into it as well as it used to. Well, I'm not the only one with that problem. But physically, there has to be an origin of the species. You have to make that suit for the first time, no matter how many times you wear it. And that's something we really must address. How do we stop digging up oil? What's the alternative to it?
Martin, on that very fundamental point, we're going to stop, and then we'll move on to Q&A. But before Q&A, we do have the video. So please, Charles.
I'd like to invite Michelle Hadwiger, Director of Global Business Development from Colorado's Office of Economic Development and International Trade, to give a brief presentation. And thank you for being a sponsor of this great session. Michelle.
Thank you. As mentioned, I'm Michelle Hadwiger. I'm the Director of Global Business for the Office of Economic Development International Trade in Colorado, which is a division of the Colorado Governor's Office. And we're pleased to participate in this session particularly because it does align directly with the governor and the administration's goals and the state of Colorado's priorities to have a successful transition to the new energy economy. And with that, we recognize that many of you may not be familiar with Colorado, so this is less of a sales pitch and more of a brand awareness about all of the great things that Colorado has. And I'll just show you a quick video to give you an example of what it's like to live and work in Colorado first. From that video, you probably noticed that Colorado is a beautiful state, but more than just the beauty of the state, we wanted to demonstrate that Colorado does inspire the extraordinary. And with that, we have an extraordinary workforce and talented workforce, and wanted to give you a few data points on what makes Colorado's economy so successful. So for starters, we do have one of the most educated workforces in the country, second just behind Massachusetts. And we often rank at the top of U.S. publications like Forbes, CSNBC, and U.S. World News Report for having one of the most talented and productive workforces in the country. During the expansion and before the pandemic, we were the third fastest growing state in both population and employment, which increased 14% and 22% respectively. Our workforce was fed by an average of 50,000 immigrants to the state looking for opportunities to have productive work in Colorado, and of that, almost 60,000 of those were advanced degrees with a bachelor's degree or higher each year. We have the second highest share of adults with an advanced degree and the fifth highest share of STEM employed workforce and the fifth highest labor participation rate in the country, which also brings back to the quality of life and goes back to our productivity. Recent data shows that these trends have continued to stay at those levels in spite of the pandemic. So we're excited to see Colorado maintain our position. Part of that inspiration for the extraordinary is also related directly to our economic output. And in this chart, you'll see on the left, you can see the growth rate of the state's high-tech and strategic growth industries, or as we call knowledge-based industry clusters, those industries that typically reinvest 30% or more of their net profits back into research and development-oriented activities. And you'll see that we led the nation in all of these clusters, and that our relative growth was particularly impressive in the aerospace, bioscience, and energy sectors, respectively. We outpaced the nation between 15 and 25 percentage points during the previous expansion. And while it's not shown here, of these high-tech clusters, they're also more concentrated than any other state in the nation by over 20 percentage points. So again, speaking to the fact that Colorado moves more people in and out of the state than we do goods and services, and we are over-indexed on the knowledge-based, STEM-based industries. And just to highlight how dense these clusters have become, you can see the map on the right, which just shows you sort of some of the big multinational corporations within all of those respective industries that have chosen Colorado as either their headquarters or their largest population of employment as a destination for new investment. And that spans the spectrum from information technology, defense, energy, traditional oil and gas. All of the sectors are identified in our industry cluster portfolio. And finally, Colorado's inspiring the most extraordinary thing, which I think is a leadership position in the global energy transition space. Our state is uniquely positioned to lead this important and inevitable revolution in energy production, and we have a unique mix of cooperating market participants, which I think makes that more possible. We have industry, and then we have the research institutions, and we also have government that's put its weight behind it, and then the people of Colorado, the value proposition for the people who choose to live there with purpose, passion, you know, corporate social responsibility, which I think is really important in terms of the transition to the new energy economy. You do have to have people that buy into the belief that that's needed. On the industry side, our state is home to companies like a Danish multinational wind turbine manufacturer, Vestas, which many of you may know of. We produce the blades, we produce the poles, we produce some of the turbines and engines. We also are home to startups like Solid State Battery, battery companies, a company called Solid Power, which is partnered with Ford, BMW, and Hyundai already. And then our largest utility provider in Colorado has committed to provide 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050. And the research in academia, we have 33 federally funded laboratories in the state, along with 6 research institutions. These organizations often partner, work together to present the challenges that come with the energy sector and collaboratively partner on joint ventures and research partnerships to advance the technologies. Perhaps the most famous asset in this space is the National Renewable Energy Lab, federally funded, located in Jefferson County, Colorado. And we do have representation from Jefferson County, Metro Denver Economic Development, and Denver Office of Economic Development here with us today as well. And that research laboratory is the only laboratory in the nation that is in the research and development and commercialization of renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that the people of Colorado have shown their overwhelming support for the renewable energy sector throughout the years through ballot initiatives, investment, and spending that has led for Colorado to be the seventh, the state with the seventh most installed wind capacity, 10th in solar, and 6th in the concentration of zero emission vehicles, with bold initiatives to increase those rankings even further. Our government and our legislature are aligned with these priorities, and our governor, when he first took office, promised that the state's largest owned utility would be 100% production would come, 100% of our energy production would come from our largest utility by 2040. Since then, the administration has also pushed greenhouse gas pollution reduction roadmaps, clean trucking strategies, electric vehicle plans, all of these things to help us meet our energy transition goals. And then we recently announced a global energy park, which will be an outside of defense and federal research laboratory opportunity for small, medium-sized businesses to help take their commercialization goals a step beyond without having to fall subject to the Department of Energy's requirements on the campus. So it'll be a unique opportunity for more collaboration between academia, industry, and government. So I just wanted to give you a quick overview of Colorado's position in the energy space, show you what Colorado looks like, and hope that you'll come visit, and hope that you would consider investment there in the future as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. I'd like to throw it back to Robert for just a few questions before we break for lunch.
Yep. Thank you, Charles. I appreciate that time is short, and we've covered quite a lot of topics this morning in terms of just transition and net zero. But I would appreciate some questions from the floor or even reflections from the floor. So please, we do have mics as ever.
Tim Clark, Deep Miner. I want to get your opinion on carbon credits. It's a huge industry and it's growing quite rapidly. Is it a necessary evil and step on the way, or are we just masking an issue and allowing us to present ourselves as doing something while ignoring the problem?
Thank you.
I'm volunteering Helen for this one.
I was going to volunteer you, Martin. Actually, it's not something that I have lots of insight onto, that area. So I won't try to answer the question.
I have no particular experience in that. I would just hark back to what Martin says about being more fundamentally involved in the whole decarbonisation sphere rather than looking at perhaps sticking plasters that go over the top of some of the activities. I think it's the same kind of argument as the one you mentioned about trees.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it for me. I mean, carbon credits, I won't pretend in the slightest to be an expert in the whole thing, or far from it. I understand the concept of why you would do it, but I wonder, does it lend itself to, you can plant loads of trees and save lots of carbon, but you haven't actually replaced the oil. And I think for me, that's a fundamental thing that people need to start looking at a little bit more, is actually replacing our dependence on the oil rather than measuring the carbon that's floating around as a consequence of digging the stuff up in the first place.
Okay, any more questions from the floor? Yes, please. Got one at the back and then one near the front.
Thank you. Bob Watson, Morocco Gold. There's been no mention of energy efficiency in the debate. How do you rate that as a way of helping this ambition that we have to net zero?
Consumer behaviour.
Yeah, so I think, again, if I just use a UK example, then the biggest progress we've made in decarbonisation is in energy, the carbon that comes from our energy production. And much of that reduction has come from efficiency drive, so products being more efficient, you know, more awareness of how we're using things. And I think as we come into, you know, challenging times with energy prices, we're going to have to double down on efficiency for both individuals and, you know, organizations that are using a lot of power. And I think there's more power in the data that we've got that we're perhaps not using, you know, as powerfully as we could. And this comes back to the consumer and, you know, how do we educate and empower people to make choices by giving them more information about how they can be more efficient. So I think it's, you know, come a long way up to, you know, probably the last 10 years where, but now we need the next kind of move around how do we move forward for that. That's for the UK environment, but it can have it is a big lever for your energy decarbonisation, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so three things spring to mind that we're doing at Mitchell and Scotland Innovation Park. The first is hosting some companies who are actively involved in data analysis and crunching, like data monitoring systems or Tronius. Secondly, we're going to be the home for the Locate project, which is a heavy-duty drivetrain test facility to help organisations tune their product as much as possible to the requirements of the circumstance they face. You know, operating a refuse collection vehicle in the middle of Glasgow is not the same as the middle of Islay or in the Orkneys. So how do you find that right balance between, for example, hydrogen fuel cell and battery power? And the third is, in our Skills Academy, we've gone out to the market and said what is required at the moment. And I mentioned earlier on wind turbines, and I mentioned air source and ground source heat pumps. But another course that we're going to be operating is pre-1919 buildings, because they represent a specific challenge, but also a specific opportunity in terms of insulation.
And I agree, I think you're absolutely spot on. Energy efficiency is huge, and I think it's not just energy efficiency, it's resource efficiency, like I said, about our ethos, about reutilising as much as you can, and behavioural change. My wife's going to hate me now, she's sitting in the front, she walks into every room in the house and turns the light on when she walks in, never turns it off when she walks out. Isn't that right? We have an argument about it regularly. But it's behavioural change, which can be far more difficult than you'd like to believe it should be to get to happen. But ultimately, we do all that, best energy efficiency, less use of energy, maximum utilisation of resources, take as much carbon as you can off the planet. There's still a number out there somewhere. This is the amount of carbon we need to live our daily lives, and that's what I think we have to look at a little bit more. What is that carbon going to be? And on a more positive note, because I'm beginning to think I'm sounding really whingy, we have rounded the corner of Celtic Renewables. We have built the first refinery. We are a first of a kind. This is the first biorefinery of its kind anywhere in the world, and we have done it. The next step for us is to now to globally deploy this technology at much larger scale with totally different resources all over the world. It'll be food, it'll be other drinks industries, whatever. Every country has an industry that generates residue, and we are now in a state where we can take that and capitalise it monetarily. This isn't just about environmental sustainability, and this is the important thing that's left out a lot. Industries like ours must be economically viable as well as environmentally viable. And that's where the money for the foreign direct investment becomes absolutely critical. You can monetize us. You can capitalize us. We've done the difficult stuff to get to where we are. And if we can do it, so can loads and loads of other companies. And you add all those up. As my granny always told us, if you look after the pennies, the pounds look after themselves. And there's lots of pennies out there. And you guys can fund it. You can make sure that it happens. And the technology is there. And I firmly believe we can and must have a bioeconomy going ahead.
Thank you, Martin. Always good to listen to your granny.
Charles, you're listening to my granny.
Charles, I'm conscious of time. Do we have time for one or two more questions from the floor?
How about one more question? I saw one here in the middle of the room, right here.
Yeah, good morning. I'm Colin Smith, Chief Executive at the Scottish Wholesale Association. I'm sure a few people wondered why our logo is up. As a partner in supporting this forum. As an industry and the trade body looking after Scotland's food and drink wholesalers, we have taken the decision to help all of our members at sector, at industry level, decarbonise or help decarbonise our business. With that in mind, we have set out in a decarbonisation of the wholesale industry. It's a three-phase project. First phase, looking at our fleet. Second phase, looking at our buildings and energy use. Third phase, looking at our people and actually how they move around within the business environment to and from their work as well. I think as partners actually with Ballard Motive Systems, looking at hydrogen fuel cell within our HGVs and where we hope to be one of the first in the UK to have a hydrogen fuel cell HGV in the road in the next year or two, and sitting on the Scottish Government's new HGV Zero Emission Task Force, what is evident is that there is first mover advantage. I think Greg mentioned that. And when we're looking at a just transition and the cost involved in transitioning to net zero, and whatever that may be, our buildings, our vehicles, etc., it strikes me that the SMEs are going to be the ones that are going to lose out at the detriment of the larger investors who can afford to invest quickly and adapt and gain competitive advantage. I just wonder what the panel think is needed to ensure that just transition so that the SMEs aren't left behind. And in that context, within food and drink, 90% of food and drink wholesalers in Scotland are SMEs. Thank you.
Thank you, Colin. It's a fairly significant question to end on, but it's an important one. Martin, shall we take it from your end and just work through the panel?
I don't have the answers to everything. I don't have the answers to much, really. But it's a difficult one. But I think there's the view of the sector and in the individual. And I suppose the fear is that the individual gets lost in the overview of the sector. So decarbonising food and drink is a big job. The guy who has the corner shop, the guy who's a bakery, that's a difficult one to get left behind. And I'd love to have the answer for you, but I don't. I think if the sector can decarbonise, so it takes the pressure off the individual.
Helen, anything you'd like to contribute to that?
Yeah, I think, in the whole transition and the just transition, it is this who goes first, because if you go before the subsidies or investments, then do you get that first mover advantage? But we haven't really yet got the mass market either for these services. So, again, I don't have the silver bullet for that one. It's a tough question. We're going to have to work it through with these things about who goes first and what's the position for those who follow.
It was forced upon us during lockdown and businesses fell over. There's a harsh economic reality behind all this as well, and we just need to rise up to it a little bit and see what can be done. I don't know what it can be done, but we all saw it during lockdown, businesses that couldn't survive. Some will survive, some won't survive, and it's how much are we going to enforce? Governments, and as we get closer and closer to the doomsday figures for climate change, and this becomes an imperative rather than a luxury, and I don't think it is a luxury anymore. I think we've stopped justifying why we're tackling climate change, and now we need to start focusing on how, much more about how we do it.
Greg, any?
Yeah, I think that what we're trying to do, certainly in our activity, is make it as or increase the percentage of SMEs succeeding. So we've put in place, as I mentioned before, the Skills Academy to train and develop people. We've got innovation labs in a small maker space where they can try things out and test them, get access to the National Manufacturing Institute of Scotland, get access to the three local universities. We put them through a 16-week accelerator program such that they understand the new one that we're doing. So we've had two so far with 19 companies. The next one is basically going to start off all about funding. How do you pitch? How do you make sure that you are ready and as robust as you possibly can be to go out in that wide world? At the end of the day, as Martin said, there will be some that will win and some that won't. Those that won't, we're hoping to put together a bit of a safety net so we can catch them and use their knowledge and experience to spin off into other areas. We don't have a magic bullet or silver bullet or whatever, but if we can do as much as we can to help them, then I think we've succeeded in some way.
Thank you, Greg. Charles, I'm conscious of the time. We've got a big red screen sitting in front of us.
Yes, it's that time. It's lunchtime. Robert, thank you so much. Thank you, Greg, Helen, Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks, Robert.
And special thanks to our sponsor, Colorado Edit, Michelle Hadwiger. Thank you very much. We're going to break for lunch. It is in the same place where we were for the networking break. That is going to be wrapping up at 1 o'clock sharp, and we need to be back in here to kick off our next session and invite our next sponsor, Invest Hong Kong. Thank you very much. Did you say Invest Hong Kong?